Hi, folks. Welcome, and thanks for joining us on The Cream of the Crop, a podcast dedicated to agriculture. We talk to top leaders, share top ideas, and discuss top trends and products. We get to the heart of ag and put the issues on the table. Hi, folks, and welcome. This is Justin Machel, co-host, along with Steve Maxwell, CEO of Highland Ag Solutions, and Susie Friedland. We got a special show. We actually have a continuation of the podcast from last week. We've got Jerome Crosby back on the line with us again. The topic of conversation was the response to the coronavirus and the impacts or the potential impacts of the fresh produce industry. And Jerome did a great job of educating consumers and letting us know what is going on in the industry, the impacts that that this is having on particular labor for the blueberry farmers and all farmers in the United States. So we want to kind of recap that. It's been a week. It's been a very fluid situation at the government, and there could be some changes, so we want to get him on the line. So let me just go through his credentials again for folks that may not have tuned in to the first podcast. Jerome, he's the farmer owner of Pine Needle Farms in Georgia. He's the president of the Georgia Berry Exchange, chairman of the Georgia Blueberry Commodity Commission. He's also a board member of the Georgia Fruit and Vegetable Growers Association and a member of the Agricultural Trade Advisory Committee. Great experience, great depth. He's definitely plugged into the industry. He's plugged into what's going on in Washington. Jerome, welcome back to the show. We appreciate having you on today. And we just want to get an update from you. What's gone on at Capitol Hill? Are there any changes from the last podcast? We had some labor situations that we discussed in the previous one. So if you can give us an update on where things are today, we'd love to hear from you.
Well, thank you, Justin and Steve. It's good to be with you again. It has been a busy week. We did get some updates on items that we discussed last week, and I would say that it's been a good week in the sense that it's been positive. Our government agencies have been able to deliver the message that they gave us last week on the H-2A. They have been consistent. And as of today, we've not seen their statements back up any. The H-2A applications have been being processed. I am aware of some workers who actually transitioned through the system and were able to move across the border over the weekend and arrive at their job sites. What the consulate has promised us through the H-2A program is that they would process applications on those individuals who had previously been fingerprinted and screened and worked under an H-2A program before. And they have honored that commitment. So those H-2A workers that have been through the system before are being processed and are being moved through the system. The second item that they are doing, they've created a way to screen these workers without an increased amount of interaction so that the virus doesn't spread, to get them processed and through the border. They are doing it by appointment, and all of the appointments that are on the calendar are being honored by the consulate. So that's all good news for the farming community and for the American consumer. Translate that to what it means for the American consumer. It means that you will be consuming American-grown fruit that is supervised under a federally mandated American food safety system. I think that is great for the American consumer. It gives us a tremendous level of protection. If there is a concern on the table today for the H-2A program, it is the upcoming appointments that need to be made at the consulate to review and give visas to H-2A workers who are calendared to arrive in the Southeast in the next 2 to 3 weeks as the crop ripens. And that will be our critical mass is the next 30 days to get those workers processed and across the border in a timely manner. But fortunately and thankfully, as of today, the program is working, and our government is meeting the commitments that they have made to us. So that's all good news, not for just the farmers, but for the American consumer as well.
Jerome, has anything changed in regards to the workers that have not participated in the H-2A program before? So you mentioned that workers that have been fingerprinted, that have been here before, they're the ones that are going to get processed and move through. Is the stance still that the new workers are not going to be processed for a period of time?
We haven't received the clarification on that we would like to have at this time, Justin. I don't want to spread wrong information. I know the discussions are ongoing. There is a good group of people involved with trying to streamline that process. There's also a conversation being had about transferring H-2A workers who are in country that may have an expiring visa. And what that means is they come in on a visa for 6 to 9 months. And after that period of time under the program, they have to return home. So the farming community has asked the question is, if they're already here and they've been here for 6 to 9 months, can we extend their visa and transfer them to another contract with a different farming operation? That makes a lot of sense. It is being fleshed out, and the conversation started last week, but I don't think it's at a point that this week a definitive answer has been given.
Jerome, this is Steve. Wanted to ask you too, we had some great feedback last week from the last week's podcast. We did have some that were concerned about possibly, American workers that were maybe being laid off under the circumstances we're in right now. And workers coming from another country taking some of those jobs. And I just wanted to know, could you just expound a little deeper on how that process works between the U.S. worker that wants to be, a worker for your operation versus we're putting in H-2A workers? Can you explain, just go down that path just a little bit?
Yes, be glad to, Steve. And that question does come up. And it is a very valid question. Why do we want to bring in a worker from outside the country when we may have workers here who need a job? Under the H-2A program, the consumer and the American needs to know that our government mandates that as a farmer, if I have an H-2A workforce, I am also required to advertise locally that I have job openings for local American workers. And should any American apply to work with the farm, I have to hire them and pay them at a commensurate rate that's actually above what the H-2A worker is compensated for. So I can't turn down that American worker. It is mandatory that I hire them to fill the slot.
So they basically get first right of refusal.
They do. The reality is, and that's a good thing. We don't disagree with that in the farming community. But the reality is, if American workers were willing to do the job that I have on my farm available for them, then I would not need an H-2A worker. The reality is that Americans years ago put themselves in a position, and I'm thankful that we live in a capitalist economy and we had good educational system, and people were able to move on in life and get jobs in cities and factories and do things with a higher skill set, and they didn't have to work on the farm anymore with manual labor. And quite frankly, Americans are really not interested in an 8 or 10 hour day with a hoe or a shovel or a rake or bending over and picking up materials and lifting it in 90 plus degree heat. They just don't sign up for that kind of work like they used to. Also, our government doesn't allow us to work teenagers like I know many of us did, like you and I, Steve. We're a little older, but we remember working on the farms during high school.
We were born in the wrong generation, Jerome.
Obviously. But I can't work the kids that were like you and I worked when we were 14 and 15 on the farm. So there's the workforce is not there. And the farms used to be small, and five or six people could help a farm family with the mother and the father and the children and grandparents get a crop in. Now some of these farms take, you know, tens and hundreds of workers to get the crop in because it's a true commercial operation. And in these rural communities, you don't have that American workforce there. And let me make two other points along that line with the rural workforce and with the harvest. The harvest on my farm only lasts about 6 weeks. That's a long season with hand labor. It's 6 weeks. It could be 4 weeks.
So, Jerome, what you're saying is you work an entire year preparing for this crop, and it all comes to a head in a 6 week window.
In a 6 week window. So that how can an American? What is that American going to do for the remaining 40 plus weeks of the year to make a living? And where an H-2A worker is willing to come in for 6 or 9 months and be on a contract to work on a farm in Florida and then a farm in Georgia and a farm in North Carolina and fills a niche that the American worker can't do.
That's a great point.
So there's a logistical item there to deal with. And on a final note, and this is not meant to be negative, but it's a fact. These workers, these American workers, maybe the comment was made that they're being laid off. They may be laid off in a sense, but they are receiving compensation and unemployment. And I just have to say that I know in Georgia that if you're laid off of work and you file for unemployment compensation through the Georgia Department of Labor, the pay rate for unemployment is at a higher rate than farm labor makes. So it incentivizes a person to stay home and draw unemployment versus go to the farm and work in that 90 plus degree heat and dirt and the elements. So I'm not saying that to be negative or positive. I'm just stating it as a fact, and the listener can disseminate that information. But it's a reality that I deal with as a farmer. That what I don't want to happen is for a farmer to be criticized to say, well, you're not working that American worker. It may be that that worker has no incentive to come work on my farm, and there's always a reason for that.
Sure, that makes sense. Makes perfect sense. Another question is, as we've entered this new era of not touching one another and washing our hands often, and it's come up, and we wanted to get your thoughts on it. And we've asked Susie to come in too because she's had some experience in this world. But, you know, how safe is the food supply? How much is the food supply handled on your end? That whole process, when it comes to the store, we're taking it home. There's a lot of concern. Susie, you want to allude to that, some of the things you've talked about?
Right. Well, one question, and I know that maybe you handled it in the other part one of the podcast, but Jerome, when you say workers are screened, so they're coming in from another country, and I know people at home are like, well, how do I know they're not sick? So I'm assuming that through a process in the H-2A application that they're also giving them some kind of medical review, or is that happening?
Yes, absolutely. When the workers, and you maybe to visualize this, and I am oversimplifying it a little bit, but the worker may live in somewhere in, and we'll use Mexico for an example. They probably live 1 or 2 or 3 hours drive or bus ride from the border, from the American border, whether it's in Monterey or Nogales or wherever they cross the border. So that worker has to have an appointment at the consulate in Monterey where they will cross the border. He arrives within a 3 to 5 day period, and he receives paperwork from the consulate that requires him to get a physical. He comes into town, he's fingerprinted, he's verbally interviewed if he's never been across the border with a work visa, and physicals are often done through a physician. In other words, he visits a doctor, he gets checked for tuberculosis, other items and issues like that.
Okay.
And there is a screening. And I think since the virus, they've even increased that screening some to include temperature checks and things like that. So that's done. I will also say that even here, once they are in the states and we have them on the farms, our state health agency here in Georgia, I can't speak for Florida and other states, but we actually have a team come out from the Department of Health and Human Services that does on-farm screenings and checks blood pressures and temperatures and consults with the workers with Spanish-speaking help to make sure that these people don't have health issues or see if they have some need that needs to be attended to while they're here in our employ.
Okay, so that's a perfect way into food safety, because not only do we have food safety standards for the packaging and the produce lines and so forth, but I mean, you're saying we have physical screenings, it sounds like, at 2 points for incoming yes. H-2A employees. Okay.
That's true. And there's even a voluntary conversation ongoing as we speak in the blueberry community on some conference calls I've been on to increase and enhance the on-site food safety. We have meetings and regulations to where we go daily and weekly go over hygiene issues. There are certain in farms with, you know, large workforces, you even have people tasked with sanitary items. You have hand wash stations in the field, you know, restroom facilities. The supervisors are required to make sure that care is taken, that they wear proper clothing, no jewelry in the field, no chewing gum, no smoking, no drinking and eating in the field. So your the produce and fruits and the blueberries do not get contaminated. So there, again, that's when I refer to the federally mandated food safety program that we have. It starts literally at the field level on the farm all the way to that point in time that the farmer passes the product to the grocery chain.
And so has it expanded in just the last few weeks? Just looking out into blueberry season, are there more levels that you guys are looking at right now?
Yes, the plans are, and the blueberry community in particular, the produce community felt like that we needed to be proactive. And so they started building a list of suggestions to put in front of the consulate and the agencies who provide oversight to us to say, okay, we'll do screening. We'll have temperature checks. We'll have additional sanitation regime going on. And maybe instead of cleaning weekly, we clean daily, wash down, wipe down, or periodical through the days. You know, what can we do to ensure and enhance a safety protocol to combat a viral issue? Just to show that we're trying to do everything we can. There's still a lot of unknowns out there, but we're trying to use common sense and do our part until our government figures out exactly what we need to do. And like I want to go back to something Steve and I discussed last week in the podcast. It is not a foodborne virus. Get that across. It doesn't come in your food. It's transmitted human to human. So if we can take care of that aspect of it, our food is safe. Let's make sure we get that message to the consumer as well.
Well, Jerome, it sounds like you guys do so much during the season, in that 6-week season, to take care of your workers. You have great stringent food safety programs. The confidence in the food safety has got to be at an all-time high, in my opinion, from farmers, from consumers. We want to take a second to talk to you about the time leading up to the season, if you will. For consumers that don't know what goes into growing a blueberry crop and what goes into preparing for the harvest, can you walk us through what you're doing today? You mentioned that your season's coming up here in just a few short weeks, and there's a lot that goes into it. You're busy right now trying to prepare for the season. Can you just walk our consumers through what it takes to get ready for the season and what you guys are doing today?
The point we're at in the blueberry season today is we're at least at midpoint or three-fourths through with the bloom. which is the white blooms on the fruit. This is called setting the crop. If we get good pollination and if the blooms are protected from severe weather events such as cold and or frost, then once the bloom is pollinated and the white bloom petal falls to the ground, it leaves behind a blueberry. We are beginning to fertilize the plants. We have new leaf growth material on the plants, and it's like all things in the spring, it's blossoming out. So we're feeding the plant, it's waking up, it's getting fertilized and nutrition. We do have to spray to keep some of the pests away that would destroy and consume the fruit. We're in that stage of the process. There are things that we do to grow and ripen the fruit to help it and enhance it, make it look better, taste better. There's a period of time ahead of the harvest when it starts ripening that we step away from it. And we make sure that it's protected, that there's been no application of any chemical that's not allowed by the EPA or the EPD. You know, we've got to deliver a product that's safe and free from any pathogen or chemical that doesn't need to be there. That's the stage we're at. We're cleaning up the fields and getting them ready. In a couple of weeks, that time will have passed. And then we have a 2 or 3 week period to where we get to just watch the fruit turn blue. Maybe that was a good description.
It was. And again, we want to just take that time to educate, you know, consumers that, you know, that may not know what goes into it. They're so used to just running into a grocery store and picking up a package of blueberries and other fresh fruits and vegetables. They haven't stopped to think, where does it come from? What's this process? They really don't have the education behind it. They're just so used to running in and picking it up as they need it. So
yeah, they do. And let me, you know, I just maybe one better visual of it. I started the day yesterday morning at daylight, turning on wells to water it, and also to give it fertilizer that we do as a liquid fertilizer into the well. By 8:30 or 9 o'clock, the wells are running, the fertilizer's going. Then we start putting out a granular fertilizer. We're cleaning weeds out of the field and getting them cleaned up. We're doing some plowing and maintenance in the field. So we were doing that all through the day. We were ordering additional materials such as fertilizer and some spray aids to the farm, some fungicides. And during the heat of the day, we're making sure we hope the bees are out there pollinating. And then at dark last night, the sun set about 8 o'clock, we had, we're dealing with thrips in the bloom. It's an insect that will get in the bloom and it will eat around the edge of the bloom and it can destroy the blueberry or cause the blueberry to have scarring. So we have to spray. Well, we started spraying last night at 8 o'clock because we waited for the bees, the pollinators, to go back home to their box. And then we got on a sprayer and we sprayed last night until 12 or 1 o'clock and we stopped spraying then, so that material has time to dry before the dew falls. And once it dries, it's no longer toxic to the bees and the pollinators. So we're in bed at 1 o'clock last night and we're up again today before daylight going again. So that's a daily routine right now. I think that's about a 16-hour day.
There's so much that goes into it, and farmers work just an insane amount of hours to produce food for this nation. It's amazing the blood, sweat, and tears that you guys put out every day to provide that food. Susie, I think you had a question on food safety. You know, the farmers have such good programs in the packing house, on the farm. They produce a great, safe crop. And then when that crop goes to the stores, what happens then? I think
that's a little scary because I know we were just talking about that earlier before we started recording. If you watch my ex-father-in-law, he picks everything up, smells it, touches it, squeezes it, and puts it back. How many people are doing that? How many produce employees are, what are they doing? Because all this stuff is happening at the farm level and they're doing such a great job, and then it hits the warehouse. What happens? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that you know, that's a concern, Susie. In the blueberry world, the blueberry, once it's blue on my bush, if it's hand harvested, it's touched one time. The harvester picks the berry off of the bush and puts it in a little bucket. The bucket is dumped into a lug. It's not touched by human hands on the farm, but one time by that harvester. Once it gets in the lug, it goes to a pallet and eventually to a packing facility. At the packing facility, all of the employees there are wearing hair nets, masks. If they have a beard, if it's a guy, he's wearing a beard net. If they're wearing gloves, all of the tables and materials at the packing facility are stainless steel. They're sanitized and washed down daily with a chlorine solution. The inspectors with gloves, the fruit can go down an inspection table and with gloved hands, they'll take out bad fruit, i.e. it's such as it's green or red, it's not ripened like it should be. So that when you get that clamshell at the grocery store, it's all blue fruit. But when you see the clamshell at the grocery store of blueberries, you need to understand that it is fresh from the field, and other than the person who picked the berry off of the bush, it's not been touched. It's been down some conveyor belts, it's in some buckets, but it is raw fruit, fresh fruit from the bush. That does not mean it means it's sanitized or it is safe and it's fresh, but it still needs to be washed like your grandmother washed it. We were laughing about that earlier, you know, but my grandmother, when she picked fruit out of her garden, the first thing she did was put it in her kitchen sink and wash it. And a consumer needs to do the same thing. While it is fresh, you still need to wash it. But it has not been touched by a lot of human hands. Now, once the product is on the grocery store shelf, that is, I go in a grocery store with my wife and I see people picking it up and turning it over and handling it and setting it down. And then once
bringing
they
it to
say
their
it's
nose.
Okay, yeah. And then they reach to the back and get one that nobody else has touched, you know, and leave that one out front for the next guy. And you just got to use common sense. And I say this in all the love and compassion I can muster, but a mother takes a child to a grocery store, the kid's ill, they're trying to shop, she's got a lot on her mind, she puts the kid in the buggy, and the produce aisle and fruit aisle is often close to the front, and she goes by and she picks up something the child likes, if it's a strawberry or a blueberry, and just hands it to the child, and he opens it and he starts eating it, and he's quiet, and mama's happy. But it's not the farmer's fault that it hadn't been washed at that point. I just think the consumer needs to be aware of that.
Mic drop.
There is some consumer responsibility here, right?
Just a wee little bit.
But Jerome, listen, this has been fun. Thank you so much again. You've been very insightful with your information. And we just want to let the audience know we're going to continue with Jerome through his season. We're going to have camera crews up in Georgia. And for those that are interested, we're going to follow him through an entire season this year. So every other week or so, we're going to be producing the next phase of a blueberry grower's life. So you're hearing the first parts. And, of course, we're in a unique situation with our nation right now, and hopefully we're going to come out of this virus situation soon. But we thought it'd be really good to follow a grower from the beginning and hear their concerns and get a visual of everything they go through to produce a crop for us. Jerome, thank you so much, and for millions of other farmers out there just like you that are doing what you do to provide a great nutritious food for us that we enjoy every day. And one silver lining of all this we're going through with the virus is the fact that I think people have had to slow down, and we're thinking about things that we don't normally think about, such as where our medical supplies come from, where does our food supply come from. And we want to take advantage of that here at Highland, to not to preach or to anything like that or condemn in any way, but just to explain and educate, because it's so critically important, and we just, as human beings, do not take the time to think about the important things. I'll finish up with one story I heard many years ago. A pastor, Chuck Swindoll, he used to be my favorite pastor I would listen to. He told this story of a woman who was on the Titanic in first class, and she was about to, they were given the command to leave the Titanic. It's a true story. She asked if she could go back to her room. She had forgotten something, and the man told her she had 3 minutes and the lifeboat was going to go down. She goes back to her room. She goes past all of her diamonds, all of her jewelry, all of her fur, and she reaches for a bag of oranges beside her bed, and she takes the bag of oranges and gets on the lifeboat, and then the rest is history. But in one fatal moment, everything that was valuable became worthless, and everything that was worthless became priceless. That bag of food was going to keep them alive, those bag of oranges on that boat. She didn't know how long they were going to be on that boat. And I think that's a moment in time for our nation right now. It's a time to reflect. It's a time, I think it's a blessing in disguise, to take a real look at what's important in life, and our food supply is one of those. And we're going to take full advantage of it in the coming weeks and months as you get through your crop. We want to follow you and tell your story, which will be the same story of a million of other growers. So thank you for participating in that with us, Jerome. And thank you again for your time today.
Well, thank you, Steve. That was an awesome story, and I think that sets it up. I look forward to this this season, and let's see what it holds for all of us.
Jerome, Justin, again, just want to say thanks. We appreciate having you on here. We're excited to follow you through the season. And then Susie, welcome aboard to the show.
Thank you, Jerome, for teaching me. That's very valuable information.
I hope I can deliver. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you learn something.
All right, folks, thanks for tuning in today to the broadcast. We appreciate you and your time and support. Until next time, we'll see you then.
See you later.
Thank you for joining us today. This podcast has been a presentation of Haz Media, copyright 2020, all rights reserved. Be sure to follow us on social media on Instagram and Facebook at Highland Ag Solutions, and catch the video presentation of this podcast on our YouTube channel.